Hey, welcome to Plan Conversations. Here's our chat with Michael Held, VP of Design at Steelcase.
Hey, this is so nice, you know, catching up like this after all these years. Hey, seeing both of you and meeting Jason for the first time. Nice.
Yeah, I don't know where to begin, mate.
Last time it would have been when we all sort of departed.
Honkers.
Yes. That would have been a long time ago.
I remember you, and we do have another common friend in Michael Patterson, who Jason knows as well from his days at Teague. And Jason, just for a bit of context, Michael Held had Michael Patterson, his wife, Karen, and I around for dinner right before we left Hong Kong. And that was, I remember that. That was really nice.
Yeah.
But we go way back. Yeah. I mean, bloody
Taiwan.
Taiwan, my first days as a designer. Those were crazy days.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely a long time ago. And since then, even Hong Kong departed somewhat, it seems.
Over 10 years ago. It was 2013 when we left Hong Kong.
Yeah. Yeah. I joined Steelcase nearly 11 years ago. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Wow. How are you liking the US, Michael?
You know, it's like, you know this, because when you move around the world and you first and foremost, I think, learn a lot about your upbringing, your culture and your country, mm-hmm. where you're from, you know, things that you thought were amazing don't look as amazing. Other things that you didn't appreciate maybe now, you know, seem to be really amazing. And so wherever you move, you find out new things. You contextualize a lot of the stereotypes and things that you hear. And well, if I say the US, you know, I'm living in the Midwest, which is certainly not mm-hmm. representative of the whole US. I think one of the, you know, key recognitions is that as Europeans, we work incredibly hard to tell each other how different we are, right? So, I mean, mm-hmm. you go to a different country, it's very different culture, different language, different food. You dress slightly differently. Architecture has to be different, live differently and all that. But in the end, people are pretty similar. In the US, I think they've done an amazing job kind of like making everybody believe that they're the same. Although it's an incredible diverse country as well. And it's obviously an immigrant country. And so, you know, the diversity is huge, but, you know, especially at the moment, it's a bit of a strange time. And I think the rest of the world is watching because it's such an influential place. You know, when I grew up in the 80s, this was like for my grandparents, this was, the US and Switzerland were the two countries that, you would aspire to, right? To wealth, freedom, and great service, and all that, and
chips, the ages, all of that.
Yeah, man. And over time, I think you realize it's maybe not quite like that. and times change.
When you started talking about Grand Rapids, I started thinking about like our time at Teague in Seattle. And LA and how insanely different those places are. You go from Melbourne to Queensland or Brisbane. I mean, it's basically the same bloody thing with different temperature. So Australia is quite a, you know, that's why my dad said it's hard to get people to travel to Adelaide or Perth because they're basically smaller versions of the bigger cities on the East Coast. And there's not a lot of, I mean, there's, you know, beautiful coastline and there's the odd red rock out in the desert, but it's not like we have, you know, the Rockies in one state and insane deserts and canyons in another. And there's a geographical diversity probably in the US that drives a lot of it comes hand in hand with the cultural differences, but I found it fascinating. I think you made a really good point about in Europe, you make a point of how different everyone is. And even when we spent a little bit of time there, I was blown away by Germany literally being next door to another country that they speak totally different languages, you know, and you're only a couple of hours away. I mean, I know this is not a foreign question to you, Michael, but I reflect a lot on Karen and I as designers and traveling around and what that might mean, what the exposure to all these different places and actually living in certain spots means for me as a designer. Be curious to hear what you think because, you know, going from Europe to Taiwan to Hong Kong, you know, Europe to Asia, then to the US, you've ticked the box on all the three major kind of economies in the world. So what would be some takeaways in your experience that have helped inform how you've progressed as a designer? Was it all planned? I mean, I think for Karen and I, at some point we felt like we were literally a ball in a bloody pinball machine bouncing around and with no real strategy, but we ended up somewhere and then we started to think about what we wanted to do. But
those are quite a few questions, you know. How I got to Asia after studying in Germany and Ireland and Switzerland and worked in Switzerland for a while in furniture and interior design was really my desire to learn about industrial craft, manufacturing, engineering, and going to a place where things are developed that are going to be produced in the millions. And as a young designer, I thought it was an incredible, you know, aspirational goal to design something that's made a million times or more. And I don't know why that was something that at that point I felt like was important, but I don't know. Coming just out of the 90s and this whole dot-com acceleration and globalization and the whole world kind of breaking up. I mean, the 90s were like the most amazing time ever in my view, obviously because I lived through it at a certain age. But on the other hand, because it was a decade where there were no enemies, right? There was no East-West anymore. The wall came down. You literally had the feeling the whole world is becoming one, you know? People started to believe in this kind of Star Trek world, I guess. Yes, there was the Iraq war and there were, you know, of course, still very many conflicts and all that. But the big kind of polarization that happened before since Second World War was kind of gone. And I think it was a supercharged consumerism and communication and global supply chains and, you know, from cheap toy manufacturing in Taiwan, like suddenly we went to kind of like higher quality products. China came out of its shell. And so it was like an amazing time. And with that, I assume that's why I thought it's great to design something that's made a million times. And this was the key motivation actually to go to Asia. And the reason why I landed on Taiwan is because I knew somebody there, a guy called Markus Wirzog. And I visited him actually on a trip to visit my brother in New Zealand a few years prior to that. And so I had to stop over somewhere. And so I stopped over in Taiwan. I've never been to Asia before and I loved it. And so from a learning perspective in regards to as a designer and how what I take away from all of that and you know, the subsequent years of living and working in Singapore and Hong Kong is really, there's a bunch of things. I think one of them is like, great design is always rooted in diversity of ideas. And so having that kind of exposure, having this kind of like diverse inputs in a design process is something that you only start to value really when you get to do it, right? So at university, it's a bit harder to experience maybe, or maybe these days it's different. I don't know, but it wasn't quite like that for me in the 90s, I would say in Germany. And so that was a huge thing. The other thing was it was incredible humbling. You know, I thought like I'm a pretty good designer. You know, I won an award at that time. I think it was still kind of, you know, this is nice. Recognition is always nice. That hasn't really changed, I think. But, you know, maybe the value you put into like an actual design award is maybe slightly different than it was like 25 years ago. But I received a lot of good feedback for my work. You know, I think I was a good thinker and all that. I arrived in Taiwan and I was kind of like, oh my God, they're all much better designers than I am. And that wasn't maybe black and white and kind of much better designer and everything, but they knew the tools and their skills. They were fast. And I think first and foremost, in this environment that rewarded, I'd say, ideas, throughput, high quality, but probably in a slightly different way than I would have, you know, described it from my maybe German minimalism kind of.
a lot of electroplating back in those days.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Nice. I was always told, gold. Michael, your design is missing detail.
Sounds like we had some of the same clients.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's all the detail you need. I mean, there's no more. What other detail would you need? I'm not going to make it up.
One of the best briefs we ever got was, sorry to cut you off, but I want to echo for a second, jump in and echo your love of Taiwan. And I think it's one of those things that it's a country, at least from Australia's perspective, that most people didn't even know existed. So when I told people I worked in Taiwan, they said, how's Thailand going?
Yeah.
And, but when I landed there and when Karen and I went, I mean, we were just blown away. Like it was you know, it was spectacular in every sense. It was charming and small, but it was technologically advanced. The people were awesome and educated and very progressive in their thoughts. And it was a really super exciting place to be at that time. Yeah, there was an energy there. And I just want to, sorry if I cut you off, but I want to talk about this. One of the best or worst design briefs I got was from a Taiwanese guy that came into the office one day and said, I think he had a budget of around 50,000 US bucks. And he said, I want the iPod, but better. That was the brief. And then he walked out. And I'm like, okay.
You know, I think back then a lot of the, I think a lot of the briefs had some similarities to this, even in large companies, simply because the impact of what was happening in that industry was so mind-blowing. It was such a huge shift. And I think in the early 2000s, like if you would go into an IT mall or a computer shop in Taiwan, it looked a little bit like an old butchery, you know, like with kind of hooks from the ceiling and motherboards hanging down and like processors and cooling rigs, and people were into overclocking, and it was this kind of male testosterone driven kind of like component business, right? That was kind of a little bit dungeon-like, if you will. And within 2 years, the impact of these white Californian products transformed nearly every IT shop into these brightly lit, clean, well-organized places with rectangular packaging on hooks and all that. And you kind of like, this is insane, you know, like, yeah. I think it's hard to really appreciate the actual impact that had beyond the pure consumer experience. I mean, it was shifting the whole industry. During the time we lived in Taiwan, the whole industry changed so dramatically from 2002 to 2004. And you could feel that later on, you know, in Singapore and in Hong Kong, obviously as well, continuing. And yeah, I mean, Taiwan, I mean, just back to that point, like I think without, you know, the colleagues from back then, the company and that experience, I don't think I would be where I am today, simply because, you know, there was so much to learn. It was so different. And I had to learn how to get uncomfortable with myself, right? So kind of like, I had to stop thinking, you know, as a German designer, I was overthinking everything. I was kind of, before I even start drawing, I was kind of like, let's sit down and think about this. Nobody had time to think. You kind of like, you just had to, you know, just design some stuff. And while that sounds like, you know, completely irresponsible, and if we would launch products like that, I guess it was, from a crafts perspective, that was exactly what I needed. It was just this kind of like, let's do the same thing over and over and over again and continue doing it. You know, I'm still a terrible sketcher and that's never going to change, right? Taiwan didn't change that. But I think I got my bandwidth as a designer and my ability to, I think, understand what's possible and, you know, to kind of look at people and skills and strength and where the opportunities to do more, I think drastically expanded during that time. And so for me, that was like, you know, two and a half really formative years that while there didn't feel like that at all.
You articulated that moment really well, in a way I couldn't have. Like the impact of Apple and Californian design across the world was massive in the space of a couple of years. It was just pivotal. So
What caused the, or how did you end up with the Philips gig in Hong Kong, and how did you guys end up overlapping?
After about 2 years in that role at ASUS Design in Taiwan, I felt that this is like over the long run not the right environment for me. And I think the company felt likewise, you know, like the, you know, you either have a good fit or you kind of like, you know, this was good, but you know, let's move on. And so Philips were looking for somebody to fill a role in Singapore, Philips Electronics, of someone that was growing into the next level kind of leadership position. And so they were looking for a younger kind of designer to take on a design business mix kind of role, I'd say, a little bit. At the time, Philips Design had these internal roles split between creative direction and account management. And account management was kind of like internal and external customers. So it was a bit of a, like an agency model, if you will. And so I moved into kind of a mixed role as the singular designer and if you will, design manager for the internal remote control business of Philips, which at the time was the largest remote control manufacturer worldwide. And so it was on the one hand, supporting that business and winning and delivering remote control solutions to external customers. So we worked for a lot of large US and European kind of cable, set-top box suppliers. That was a big business back then. Computers started to have their own first remote controls. And of course, on the other end of the spectrum, Philips was its own customer. So they made a lot of the remote controls that Philips would be using for audio devices and televisions. And so I worked at this intersection of external, internal, physical product. And remote controls are interesting because they're kind of interaction devices, but technologically quite super basic. You know, in some cases, you have to get to kind of like, what's the 50-cent remote control or what's the $50 remote control? So the span can be quite dramatic. And they have to work with the on-screen interface. So there was, for me, a lot of learning around interaction design. And this was also at an interesting point because it was coming from the old kind of hard-coded kind of middleware world where, you know, what those devices could do was quite limited by the architecture they were built on. And they were all coming into this new world where there was more flexible architecture and programming possibilities and applications could run on top. So the interaction started to become a lot more sophisticated, and it was really this kind of like 3 years focusing on kind of like, you know, what's the best experience for being half drunk on your couch, half asleep, half but still being in control of everything. So, and a lot of user testing where people said the only way to fix it is just to unplug it. and that led eventually to a role in Hong Kong, and this is where Brandon, Karen, and I reconnected. There was a larger studio for Philips in Hong Kong. There was in Singapore, and there was a position open, and I was asked if I would be interested and applied for it, and eventually Philips decided to move us to Hong Kong, and that's then I think I stayed at Philips then for another maybe 6 years in Hong Kong.
Can I pick up on a couple of things that you said there that were they're Philipsy things, but what I saw from you, and I think it would be good for people to know. First one is, when you were talking about the remote controls, I said, oh, that's right, because I think I recall you, maybe when you moved to Hong Kong, you did a share out of your work. Something that stuck with me was, I was like, oh, okay, remote controls, what the fuck are remote controls about? And then you presented it in such a way, it was like, holy shit, this guy's got it all figured out. Like, just the gridding of buttons, the layouts, the thought that went into everything that you just discussed, right? So it's a balance between something that I hold and something that I need to use to navigate. And so that really stuck with me. The other thing that was really interesting that you pointed out, and I think you're right that this is still a valid agency model, and I think it's useful for people to hear, is when you're a young designer, you don't really always know the paths that you can take. And just because you can't sketch doesn't mean you're going to be great and influential. And I think in agencies, you're right. Quite often there's this creative path that you can stay on and you can grow creatively. And the other side is into the design management side and influencing and nurturing teams that way, and also educating and managing and nurturing relationships. And those are outside of the design team that you're working with. And that's something that maybe Karen can speak to, but she often talks about, you know, Michael did it this way. You know, when I was at Philips, I saw Michael do it this way.
Still to this day. Yeah.
She's like, we need a Michael.
Yeah, we need a Michael.
Are you hiring?
I mean, Brendan's told me from his time how many products he, you know, put to market. Like, that's just something, you know, younger designers, I'm getting less young, but in my experience, I don't really know many people put, you know, more than three products to market. If they're lucky, you got to stick around an internal company and be in a good position to take part in that. But to be somewhere where, you know, I can imagine the remote control division is, you're chasing down the technology that's possible. And every time you lock for production, you've tried to bake everything into that product that it's capable of. But you're also, your brain is probably having a range plan and allocate the features that go into each, you know, the the costing and the investments for each one of those, trying to align platforms. It just sounds like I can see where probably Brendan has been influenced by your experience there, taking that to the divisions that Brendan and Kieran worked in, like the portfolio management, then, you know, headphones portfolio. Like that was like the heyday of design for Philips from, you know, in my lifetime, pre Beats, where that, you know, kind of broke things apart. So yeah, seeing Apple, you know, change the world and then go, you know, go and influence these companies that are ready for change. It's really cool experience. I don't think anybody my age is going to get to do that, or younger designers are going to get to do that.
Well, you know, every you know, time has its kind of like place to be. I mean, in retrospect, you could also say we've been kind of like riding the tail end of some of that, because when we left, basically Philips slowly faded out of that consumer business totally. And maybe the heydays was more, you know, like in the 90s when Stefano was building that team and there was still money for, you know, in hindsight, you would say like, wow, that was like crazy experimentation. But they did so many cool things back then. And a lot of that was already fading, I think, during the time when we were there. We were certainly there when Philips shifted more and more of that work. In some cases, maybe for labor arbitrage reasons, and some cases, maybe more to be closer to manufacturing again, to Asia Pacific from Europe. But yeah, I mean, you know, I wanted to design something that gets produced a million times or more, and remote controls like made it quite easy for that goal to be achieved.
Mission accomplished.
To the point, to the point where I sometimes still go, you know, come into a hotel room today, and I'm kind of like, okay, there it is. You know, Michael Patterson and myself, we send us like every 4 or 5 years, somebody is in a hotel room and kind of like, well, sends the other photos, like, it's still there. It's unbelievable.
That's right.
Impact worked on remotes as well, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's why this big program at Philips that was kind of the culmination of what I knew back then about that part was basically the program that he worked on. And Jason, I think when you get to a certain level of complexity in these large companies, then the only way to do that is like with a systems approach at the end of the day. And I think Philips was a really, really good kind of learning ground for that, because back then I would say it had a lot of marketing excellence to some degree. There was a lot of like, there were internal functions that kind of codified and helped a process, define a process to develop the brand, the value propositions that would kind of support that brand, and how that would be all orchestrated by a system of hundreds of different designers across the world. It's such a complexity. So if you know, this is where I learned a lot about like the benefits, but also the limitations of kind of these large structures that help you orchestrate a lot of that complexity. And I think that, you know, if you looked at the work that Brandon and the team in headphone design did, for example, I don't know how many headphones we needed to get through that, but I think the whole team worked on about 300 different products a year, and the headphone was a subset of that. You can only design so many things, you need a systematic approach around this, right? You need a structure, and I think for me, I had the benefit of this kind of remote control harmonization thing, where, you know, we had like a lot of different entertainment devices made by different business units across the world. And they were all supposed to look the same, which Philips Design was amazing at. So this annual identity workshops and all that, like, was quite a process. And so it would suggest that all of these devices would work the same. But under the hood, because they all came from different suppliers and there was different architectures and all, it was impossible for all of them to work the same. So how could you then kind of like approximate this, you know, sameness as much as possible and enable an experience that is not frustrating around every corner? And so there was a strong need to do that. And traditionally, I think in design, a lot of people would have focused maybe, or the majority of people would focus probably on the higher end, because that's where you can do a lot of things. But that's where often the impact is relatively low. You get reviewers, you get a few people. I mean, those are expensive devices. At the end of the day, what you want is you want a great experience for the most basic product. And so it's impossible to probably deliver that in a program like that of complexity. But I think trying it, I think probably laid the groundwork for a lot of the, probably the ways I think. It's probably ingrained in my brain somehow.
Yeah.
I'm starting to itch. I want to learn about, we know about Philips. We know that shit. So I'm itching to hear about Steelcase and your rise over the past 10 years and your meteoric rise to leadership. Does that sound crappy enough?
It sounds cool to me.
I think I was promoted against better judgment.
How's it been? How's it going? I mean, I can ask more specific questions, but what does a day in the life look like for you? Like, what does the design team look like? We did a little digging. We can't find too much. You're pretty secretive. I think you're taking on a bit of that Apple-esque kind of exclusive, no one's ever going to work here kind of.
No, but you know, it's the Midwest, you know, there's not much to find.
I don't believe it.
Jokes aside, you know, like maybe as a transition, you know, one of the, you know, reasons why I actually joined the company, it was like, it was a bit unexpected, you know, and I don't know if we ever talked about this, but at the tail ends of this Philips experience, I was a lot more interested in robotics and genetic engineering, you know, biohacking, if you will. And so there was a lot of interesting things happening in that area back then and still are. And I was kind of like trying to find like something that could work for me as a designer in that area. I was really keen to shift the industry simply because of landfill. So once you work in consumer electronics for 10 years or so, it becomes very obvious how much there is manufactured that is pushed into the channel with the hope to sell it through. And it doesn't always happen, as we know, and more stuff is discarded. And that seemed very, very wasteful. So it wasn't like, you know, I don't want to, you know, claim that I had like an incredible conscious moment where I said, no, I need to focus on sustainability. But I was really not happy with the aspect of landfill. And so at the time, Steelcase was looking for someone to help set up an innovation practice in Asia Pacific. So the company had acquired a few years prior to that, a small local manufacturer that had a design team. So they had a bunch of designers in Hong Kong and were trying to manage them from abroad. And I think that worked to a limit. And at some moment of time, the company decided, or a few people in the company decided, that they wanted to invest in designing products in Asia for Asia and not just kind of localizing maybe American or European products. And so that's how I kind of like unexpectedly moved back into the furniture industry, which was never my intention back then. But what was very appealing is, apart from the job being in Hong Kong, was that it's an international company and it only had two designers. And I wanted to desperately get back to the project and design things, you know, like, you know, Brandon probably never told you that, but like back then, they didn't even let me near the project, right? So I'm kind of like, yeah. Well,
yeah, we got this.
We're going to take care of
it. Speak to what you're doing. You speak to what you're good at, mate.
Yeah. And so I was kind of like, no, I want to design something again. I want to be closer to the projects again. And that was very appealing, you know, like two people and trying to define something that's not yet defined, working for an American company. I've not done that before, but remaining in Hong Kong, that was very appealing. And so that's how I started.
Actually,
there.
And then over there, I had a tiny bit of context there for a second. I remember when I think Karen and I came to the Steelcase studio and you were showing us some molded parts, you know, like knuckles and nodes and things for which extrusions come together. And you're like, and you'd been there like maybe a year, maybe less. And you were just bitching about the quality of the mold flows and the flash lines. And you're like, this is fucking American shit. Hey, this is American.
I don't think I said that.
So, something along those lines. Hey, we got to throw a bit of spice into the conversation. Yeah, yeah. But what I always remember that because I'm like, okay, I know where Michael can take this. And elevating the craft, going back to elevating the craft and really at an industrial level, I thought that's something that stuck with me anyway. So as you were.
No, I mean, this is a fantastic point. You know, it's certainly And this is where I think Philips was incredibly helpful. I mean, the shift we had from how we worked with suppliers, you know, that we, instead of kind of like, hey, here's a thing we want to make, you guys quote, and whoever is the cheapest, we're going to pick you, to kind of like, let's create strategic partnerships with suppliers, evaluate them, and agree with them on a growth plan for that partnership. So what role does what supplier play? And that enabled us suddenly to get to very different qualities, I remember. So quality wasn't so much anymore like a coincidence. Oh, we got lucky in this case, and here we kind of dropped the ball. It was really very, very well orchestrated. And there was a lot more involvement. And I think, you know, that's certainly one of the things that stuck with me, is kind of like, if you as a designer really care about the outcome, not just your project being, you know, accepted, your design getting kind of waved through the process and ultimately launching, but if you really care about the quality of the execution, it's so important to work not just cross-functionally in general, but across the whole organization and supply chain, and really make sure that people understand the intent and value that. And so that was certainly one of the things that wasn't quite on the level where I think it needed to be, especially for, I think, Steelcase in Asia Pacific. Some of that has to do with the scale of those products. I mean, they're large, they're heavy. Some of that has to do with maybe the supply chain. Some of it had to do with kind of like how much care went into it, right? So if you have so many parts to make, and, you know, how much can you pay attention to each one of them? And I'm not saying that any of the qualities have been bad. I think the quality of the products overall was pretty good, and it's very solid. I mean, we are known as a brand and our products as not always as the trendiest or most design driven, but really as the kind of like qualitative. It's very reliable. It's very safe. It's very durable. And it was more kind of like the design execution sometimes. And I think a lot of the, you know, parts, I think back then, I think went through the process without too much attention at the end of the day. And so that was certainly like kind of like, it's more like an internal kind of cultural development, you know, for the design team, kind of like, pay attention, look at this. How could we change it? What could you do for this to be better? And so that was very much, I think, trying to take some of the things that I've learned over the years with, you know, working, you know, with people like you and others at Philips and Hong Kong and Singapore, and also the, you know, the people on the supply side and all that, and trying to bring some of that over. But I think the key thing really is for me the last 10 years in these three different locations that I worked for, Steelcase, and now find myself in this role in the US, is really building teams and culture, I think, is the key thing that motivates and energizes me, I'd say. There's a lot of things about the actual content of the work. I like furniture and all that, but I'm not a typical furniture designer. It's not what I studied. I don't get up every day and kind of like, oh my God, I've got a new idea for a chair or something. Like,
was it Philippe Starck that once bragged about sitting in the bathtub at 5 a.m. or 7 a.m. and having 15 ideas for a different fridge chair by the time he got out?
I'm sure he does, you know, and, you know, that's all good, you know. If that's what people are after, then by all means, please. But it's not what motivates me. I think I think the work we do is interesting simply because it affects so many people every day globally. It's work and what it actually means and people's life. And I'm very much aware about the distinction between kind of like what's usually, you know, bucketed as blue collar and white collar work. And I think a lot of the work that happens with our equipment is not always as necessary as everybody thinks, right? So, and I think COVID was a nice reminder of that. Like people that care for other people, or that, you know, pick up the trash and kind of drive it out of the city and all that. If those people don't show up for work, you have serious issues, you know. If a bunch of office workers don't turn up, would anybody notice?
The world's still here.
I don't know, but you know,
if a bunch of designers had never worked again,
yeah.
you know, I'm always joking. You could probably cut 50% of white collar jobs, and the impact to the economy would be relatively limited, if at all noticeable, versus, you know, some of the other jobs. And while that is a little bit of a provocation, of course, I think it points to the huge opportunity. I mean, it's so young. I mean, if you look at the office, the office is around for 100, 150 years, depending, you know, how far you want to stretch things. But before that, there was no office. There was no workplace like the office. I mean, there were clerical kind of like writing rooms, you know, where they copied books or, you know, a few people that could afford it, maybe do those kind of things. But apart from that, it was like craft, it was agriculture, it was physical labor. And not that I think that this is what we should go back to. That's not so much the point, but we are physical and social animals as humans. And the office has forced us into kind of like a particular model that is probably not desirable for most people. It becomes a necessary evil somehow. And so what I find fascinating about the work is maybe not often the individual furniture objects. They are great, awesome. I love furniture, but it's really this context of how they come together and enable, you know, an environment that allows a company to have successful ideas and collaboration and engaged employees and motivation, energy, inspiration, and all that versus, you know, companies that where people go in and, you know, just can't wait to get out again. And so that aspect, I think, is interesting about that. Yeah.
Jason's got his hand on his chin. That means he's got a thought.
I want to go back to that analogy of, you know, the high-end remote control, the luxury one, versus doing the one that's going to make the most effect for the most people, you know, globally. As a designer, thinking about Steelcase or Herman Miller, any of these big companies, you think about, like, you know, being on one of those cool high-end projects, envisioning a new system. But yeah, I think, like, COVID really breaks that model. Like, the value is actually about bringing efficiency and, like, health through furniture and those types of goods to the people who actually, you know, make the world move when things get into that type of situation. And it's you know, knowing that you're there solving those problems with that type of mentality is very cool. It's also like, you know, I heard a lot of stuff that kind of makes me think about the footwear business model. I worked in innovation at Adidas. We were in a really cool creative kind of output phase and the company was growing, but we were still looking over at Nike as what I would equate to like the Phillips model you're talking about. You know, Nike has a system where the designers, you know, there's hundreds and hundreds of SKUs, but they know that each one of those is going to be supported in marketing and has, you know, a path through the company that's going to, you know, not fall apart because one concept is better than another. Adidas is one of those ones where, you know, the right concept gets all of the force thrown behind it. And that was what the competition was. But Nike is one of those ones that it feels like the Phillips story you told.
They're in a German place model
now. Yeah. The German model. Yeah, super cool. Yeah, is that kind of like what's the focus really on those systems and those you know, that workforce that is always on versus the people who are home or in an office? I assume like the big concepts for, you know, office spaces and like big kind of sprawling collections is not as important as they used to be. Is that right?
Yeah, it's mixed, and you know, and I think a lot comes down to how we perceive what's actually happening around us, right? So how much of this future is already around us, we just don't recognize it as such yet. And I feel like, you know, when we talk about remote work and third places and all, those have been around way before COVID, you know. Telecommuting was a fancy word in the 90s that was used for, you know, remote work. What we've seen now is just that the technology is good enough so that everybody could do it at literally close to zero cost. And so it enables a very different ecosystem, I'd say, of places and processes and ways to collaborate and all that. And that's even more in its infancy. And that's really hard to kind of like crack for a lot of companies. And it's hard to crack for employees because our education system is molding us so much in a particular way of kind of like attending from to attention from to measuring progress in a particular way that is defensible, rational, or whatever. And I think we, with the industry and workplace consulting and all that, has been talking for a long time about the competition of ideas and how, you know, the water cooler effect and how people want to work maybe at Starbucks and how can you work at Starbucks? It's so noisy, kind of like I'm anonymous, right? So it's more I don't care about the noise. I don't want to be interrupted. It's very unlikely that this foreign, you know, this other person just comes up and kind of like interrupts my workday. You're a little bit more polite, maybe with people you don't know than with the people in the office. We go like, hey, you know? And so all of these things are around for a long time. And I think what this last couple of years were kind of like reminding us of, like, is how easy our workday was, right? So the mental load of thinking about, am I going to go in tomorrow? Who's going to be in? What do I need to bring? Is very different to kind of like just going in, sitting down, turning on a computer, where you don't have to think actually until that moment. So I think that's early days. And so I don't think this will ever go away. I think this will explode further. And the question really is like, how do you assemble teams, motivate and inspire them, and then get out of the way for them to do amazing things? Because more and more other things that we automate, wherever humans don't add value, don't focus on that stuff. It's focus on the human thing. And that has to do with really with social elements, with curation, with editing, with deciding what's relevant from a cultural perspective, because we decide what is relevant culturally for us. That's a voting mechanism. It's a human thing.
Yeah. Very cool.
All of that is awesome.
Yeah.
And that's really, really, I think it's refreshing to hear insights like that, particularly when you see a lot of clickbait, snackable content around, you know, CEOs demanding that everyone's going to go back to work and that's just the way the world's going to go. And you're like, for fuck's sake, can we all just agree to disagree on this one and realize that it's probably never going to be the same as it was? So I think the way that you broke it down, though, and focusing on, you know, there are obviously business models that require people to be on site. There are obviously business models that don't. But I love the way that you kind of packaged it, and it was more around, you know, what's right for the purpose, what's right for the case, what's right for that model, and where can people add the most value, and where do they not need to, and then. You know, I think to your point about, particularly in design education, education in general, you're trained in this slightly ideological process. And then when you get out of school, you feel like you need to apply that process. And sometimes it's hard to break your ideologies about how you should do things, you know, telling designers that they shouldn't sketch anymore, or I don't know, just break the rules, do things simpler, not overwork things. I don't know where I'm going with that, but Mike, I was trying to lead to a question that was about what does this all mean for Steelcase, and because your opinions are super sharp and your perspective is like, it's a very informative view on the future. How does that drive design at Steelcase, and what does that look like when you're, you know, talking to other aspects, other departments in the business?
Well, like, you know, like many large companies, you have a lot of amazing smart people that might not always agree on everything, right? And I think that's where the beauty is. That's where you need those frictions and tensions to actually get to better ideas. So at the end of the day, you always have to make the split somehow. There's business needs that need to be fulfilled. There's, you know, train leaving the station, and you need to hop on and you need to get going with certain things. And there's a deadline, there's expectations. We're a publicly traded company, like Millennial as well, and many other companies in that industry. There's certain expectations, of course, of, you know, what needs to be worked on and how it needs to be worked on, and the quality of ideas. And just because you're kind of like at a higher level in the organization doesn't mean that you're suddenly kind of free to do whatever you want. So it's still the same, I'd say. It just feels a little bit different than maybe being a designer on one particular project. The magic is always, and I'd say this is true for an intern as well as for a VP of design, is how much time can you reserve for thinking and creative output beyond what's minimum expected of you, right? So what are the things that you can drive forward that might have not been asked for, that nobody wanted to hear about, you know, that might be challenging certain norms and beliefs. And I think that's one of the key things. So like, how how can you, on the one hand, be a great partner that delivers what's expected so that you're not seen as like a troublemaker that's not reliable? How can you be a good partner, but yet at the same time, be critical and candid and think about the future in a more diverse way where it's not so predetermined that we just need to get better at what we already do, or more efficient, or bigger, you know, whatever it is companies wanna do. But it's also about thinking what else is happening. Where's the value migrating? You know, the large customers that we work with, they have different questions than they had 10, 20 years ago. And yes, there are the examples where people feel like, oh, they just need to come back to the office and then everything is good. I don't think a lot of people, even when they make those statements publicly, believe 100% that this is the one thing that they have to do and then suddenly everything would be good. I think it's also a sign of like maybe not really knowing what else to do. I mean, it's a really challenging time for many people in the sense that a lot of the known recipes don't work anymore when it comes to offices and the workplace. So if you look at architects and designers 20 years in the industry, you kind of like, a lot of the stuff that I kind of like worked hard to get to, you know, to this place, and I can make much faster recommendations and decisions than somebody coming out of college right now. Well, it's not true anymore because a lot of these things don't work. You might have the experience and people might listen to you, but you don't have the answer either. So the tension that a lot of these customers have is that on the one hand, they need incredible flexibility because they don't know how their business will look tomorrow. And I think the same tool is actually for design as a competence. You know, we're evolving. There's AI. People are confused and disoriented or angry or hopeful and all that. And everybody tells each other like, oh, a designer with AI is always better than a designer without AI. And you're kind of like, yeah, sure. You know, it's like with a pen, without a pen, good. But you know, next to this kind of like need for flexibility and remaining agile is then on the other hand this kind of really strange need to have a proven, guaranteed, working, predictable solution. Yeah. Because nobody wants to make the wrong move or the wrong decision or alienate people even more, or you know, do something where then leadership comes and say, oh my god, like we spent the, you know, we waited for 4 years to do one project and you do the project and it's all wrong, right? So it's really difficult. Everybody's kind of like a little bit I'm not moving. You know, and if they move, then you do maybe a pilot, and it's very difficult these days even to kind of scale a pilot across everything, because one of the fundamental challenges and misconception in this in our market is that in order to be fair, companies decided the best thing is to treat everybody the same. You know, and on the surface level, that sounds amazing, right? We're all the same. But as soon as you kind of like, oh, wait a minute, we're actually quite different, right? So what I need for work is very different than you might need for work, right? So I haven't had an own desk for a long time, you know, and Brandon, you might remember that at Philips Design, I was at some moment, they moved me into a room, you know, because oh, yeah. I think at a...
The fishbowls.
Yeah. The fishbowls.
You all had the beautiful view of the ocean.
No one was ever in there.
Yeah. I had
biggest waste of space.
Ocean view. You go there and no one was there.
I could close the room. And I'm kind of like, I don't want this. This is...
Yeah.
And at the end, I think we only put like a meeting room table in there that so that when I was there, I sat there, but like then it was mostly like a meeting room actually. And
that's
so
right.
I don't need a desk. I don't want an office. I have my bag and you know, way before Steelcase, that's how I work. But then there are other people that really need maybe a place to kind of like have a certain stability. And I'm kind of like, I'm okay with that. You know, they have a desk. I don't have a desk. But fine. For a large company, that's very difficult to deal with. If you have a few thousand employees and say, can I have whatever you want? You want this? You want that? How do you negotiate that? How do you make sure that everybody is, you know, performing on the right level? And if you go into high performance sport, which is often like an analogy these days, is like people actually decry a little bit the lack of the social aspect. You know, I mean, you might know, but I cycle a lot, right? So I'm kind of like, it's the only sport that I'm actually a little bit more interested in. You know, I actually watch once in a while. Crazy. So one of the things that is so challenging today is like the nutrition and the training plans have been so hyper specialized that people hardly ever ride together, because you've got your program, I've got my program, You know, we can maybe meet for a coffee once in a while, but like doing this together is really hard. And the nice thing about the workplace, you know, is that it's one of the last places on earth, if not the last place on earth, where you cannot choose who's going to be next to you, right? Mm-hmm. So you cannot choose like in social media and all that. I want to only listen to people that already think the same as I do. We reinforce each other and we're going to bitch about the rest of the world. And the others are all idiots, right? At work, you kind of like, you know, and this is maybe coming full loop to, you know, like your question around like, how is the US, you know? You work with all kinds of people. And as long as people are respectful with each other, I think it's fantastic. You know, I don't have to have everybody believe the same thing I believe. And I appreciate when you can debate it. If people don't want to debate it, that's fine too. You know, as long as that doesn't become like a contentious issue or something that makes working harder together, makes working together harder. And so what the workplace is this kind of like, I think it's an incredible, important social space for society. Yeah. Simply because you can't close the door and say, this is my thing and I don't want to hear and listen to anybody else. Mm-hmm. So by being at home all the time alone, this becomes harder. So I think, you know, we need to figure out what the balance of these things are. Mm-hmm. Like, how can we have our personal lives and how can we deal with the pressure that maybe our parents didn't have to deal with on that level that we have today and the next generation probably even more, yet at the same time, you know, still be together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sounds like innovation is happening where you're at. I left footwear because it was starting to get, you know, the competition was going towards sustainability and all these different things and the business models were changing and then everybody kind of ended up the same and you look for the next spot for innovation. But I mean, that type of problem to solve is super, super interesting and it's constantly evolving. So, yeah.
I'll echo what you were saying. I think that last observation about the workplace being one of those final frontiers where we don't get to choose who we collaborate with, who we work with, who we sit next to necessarily. Even as a consultancy, you know, we don't get to choose our clients. And as long as we all come together around a common set of objectives and goals, the respect is always there. I think that's a big thing. And I think it helps, at least for us, to maintain this sense of perspective and openness. And to your point, I think you said something really early on. You said great design is always rooted in diversity of ideas. And I think that, you know, wrapping a bow on the whole America thing, you know, it's such a diverse spectrum of ideas and perspectives and beliefs that...
Yep. Well, if you look at, you know, if you look at design, it's really a little bit a mixed thing, I would say, you know, and this was certainly something that became more obvious to me after moving here. You know, when I was in Munich leading furniture design globally, but working mostly with the European, with the Munich team and with the Asia team, when George Floyd was murdered. And as a follow-up of that, of course, there were a lot of discussions about, you know, the topic of race and the reality for a lot of Black folks in the U.S. in particular. And working for a U.S. company, I was, of course, involved in some of the discussion. As a German, this was like really a little bit of an odd thing because on the one hand, you feel like, you know, we have this Nazi past and we kind of like grew up as kids being very conscious of that. You know, you have to go and visit a concentration camp once with the school. You talk about this And I wouldn't say that everything's perfect, but I do feel like the way I was brought up, it was like very much top of mind, right? And so for me, having this discussion about, you know, racial inequality in the US in particular felt like, yeah, we just need to talk more about it and, you know, educate people and all that. But it's a very simplistic point of view, right? And I think, you know, coming back to this comment about diversity and the realization in Taiwan and what change with that for me in the US is really a recognition how white and colonial the design practice often is. And I don't know, Jason, you might have a slightly different take on this because I think the footwear industry or the fashion industry, probably while maybe not being healthier, I don't know, but probably has a stronger recognition for different cultural references than the actual furniture industry in particular. You know, and so over the last 2.5 years, I started to engage more and more. I'm by no means an expert, and I, you know, this is not the only thing I'm interested in, but really engaged more on this topic on, you know, minorities in design to drive actually this cultural canon. Because I think there is really, for me at least, there's a strong recognition how kind of like much what we do, product design in particular, there might be, you know, there are others, architecture has been called out as well. And it's different in different parts of the creative industry, how much that is mostly kind of like colonial white, probably also male, right? Despite the fact that, you know, Black culture had the biggest impact culturally, globally in the Western world over the last 30, 40 years on you know, music and fashion and so on and forth. But it's not really, you know, represented in the same way in especially what I do in the furniture industry. So I had a half a year ago an interesting conversation with a designer called Jomo Tariku. He's based outside of Washington, and he's a data analyst for the World Economic Fund, I think, or for the World Bank, for a global, you know, organization. And he's been asking the question, how many Black designers have actually, you know, published pieces of furniture? And so he kind of went through all the websites of the main furniture manufacturers and kind of like counted the numbers of products versus, you know, how many have been designed by Black designers. It's staggering. Dessine, I think, published this a few years ago, the study, and it's mind blowing, you know, how underrepresented that is. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, you asked about, you know, parting thoughts and vice and all that. I'm kind of like, what I'm thinking while my hat's at the moment is kind of really how to, you know, enable more of that diversity that I appreciate so much in the field that I'm practicing and have a little bit of influence, you know, in terms of like, we're not hiring a lot of different people. So it's very difficult to make this impact directly in my team on a monthly basis. But that's really the thing that I'm probably next to sustainability most excited about in that field, is actually to learn more about that and bring more about that into our process in our industry, because it's clearly missing.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, you threw out in there like footwear, definitely Adidas in general, when I was there, same issue. But things are really changing pretty quickly. I think there's a lot more voices in there, and there's been a lot of movement between different companies. And I think that allows a lot of change to happen. It's definitely something, I think design suffers from it for sure in general. And it's something we need to be more proactive about, of opening up the conversation, connecting with community, because it's so easy to call somebody you know who then knows somebody they know, and all of a sudden you've got a designer on your team, rather than opening up and, you know, reaching out into the community and finding diverse perspectives and building stronger teams that way.
Yeah, especially since we're a function or a competence that prides itself in kind of being human focused. Yeah. Right? There's supposed to be a lot of empathy and all that. And for me, really, the shift there, that this is not my, you know, those are not my words, but like words of others that help me understand that issue better, is really this kind of, instead of designing for, designing with.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of move, that you don't kind of like, oh, let's imagine how this person, you know, would feel about this and go through their day, and kind of like, how can you do that? Like, you have a totally different background, you know. But this is, I think, you know, in design education, often still is the kind of like the attempt to do that, despite the fact that that of course for a longer time there have been alternative practices and processes talked about, published, practiced. I think it's still very common that that as a designer, it's easy to imagine that we could think how it would be to walk in somebody else's shoes.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, first and foremost, thanks so much, because I think when we go silent, it's because we're soaking this up like a sponge, and we don't hear a lot of new, fresh perspectives when you get to my age. So that's a sign that what you spoke about is, I think, very informative and rich. Yeah, it's been awesome, Michael.
Yeah, and it's been too long.
And we could honestly turn this into one of those long form 3-hour things, I'm sure, because there's so much that we left off the table. Sounds like things are going well.
Yeah.
Yeah, same here. You know, like, thanks for, you know, reaching out. It was nice to connect. I was kind of like over the years always wondering, and I told Brandon last time, where are these guys living now? Because like it seems like they're spending more time in Australia again, but they're all in the US.
It's kind of like,
yeah, we're everywhere.
Yeah.
No, so
you don't get to travel to Australia anymore. So it's been a while since I've been there.
Just wait, we don't have a house yet. We're still renting. So when we buy our big compound on the peninsula, I'll send you an invite.
But Gold Coast, or where you buy?
Depending on where we buy, yeah. No, it's been a journey. I think Planco has been. I think when we listen to people like you and your path internally, and there's so many overlaps with what we're going through. It's just that the way that we do it on a daily basis feels incredibly chaotic. But a lot of the frameworks that we took, Karen and I took from Phillips, and the lessons and the system-based approach to design. And like if you've got five key models of a wearable device or something that you need, a piece of medical equipment, can we approach this with a kind of a systemic kind of perspective on design, and how do we share parts, or how do we unify experience logic? And that seems to be something that a lot of our clients really latch onto, but it feels like things they haven't really thought of before. They've always thought about designing one product, then the next.
But changing design culture internally by educating an internal team with new processes, borrowed from another industry. It takes an outsider to do that, but you have to work like you're, have a part-time job with them. And we do that for like five or six clients at a time in completely different industries. So, I think I really liked one of the points you made about, it's really about trying to find a way to carve out that space and like step back and like allow the thinking to happen. That's, I think, the chaos is hidden in trying to balance all these different inputs. Our brains are running 1,000 miles an hour, but we need to find ways to bucket days to work on Planco brand, and then each project needs its timing balanced against each other. I can't imagine, at a big company with the amount of, programs or projects that are running at one time, you have to have, some set processes, and you got to really get a handle on that, right?
No, I think the nice thing is now I'm finally in a position to build some of this. And I think we're slowly more open to see the benefits of that balance, where you have some structure and process that is repeatable. So you waste less time reinventing the wheel every time. You have a little bit more planability and foresight, and you can make better decisions because you can decide against the direction that you wanted to go in versus like not knowing where you're going anyway and just deciding something. And so I think that allows me now, and I'm also now in a position, I think, in the company to build a little bit more structure and process to avoid rediscussing everything all the time, because designers are relentless, right? So sometimes I hate it. Sometimes you don't need 20 ideas or need to, debate it forever. Sometimes you just need to make a decision, move on, and focus on the stuff can be exhausting, because everything is a design problem.
I love it. That we're laughing because that really resonates with a lot of the shit we deal with daily.
Yeah. Yep.
with ourselves. I'm not saying it.
So what I've done a bit over a year ago is like a large design leadership meeting that kind of defined the mission and vision of design at Steelcase. So we actually sat down, we wrote a mission, and we decided for four key objectives or pillars that we're going to focus on. And I think that galvanized a little bit like the thinking around some of those. And this is all under the umbrella of, and that was coming from me, is design impact. How can we maximize the impact that we have on the company and our business instead of just like always trying to defend design? It's like, how do you become this team that is less driven by egos? And so, in our case, if somebody applies for a job and has like a signature on their sketch, they wouldn't be hired. As soon as somebody signs their sketch, that's kind of.
I come from automotive design. So
yeah, exactly. And then automotive, to your point about, when you mentioned earlier competition in the sneaker world, I thought you were going after internal competition. And I think this is really, in automotive, this is so natural that you're competing for the idea. And if your idea gets chosen for that product line, you kind of like, you're elevated way beyond the status that you had going in there. And I can't really comment on that much because I never worked in that world and all that. But I do know that our approach is the reverse. We have an internal saying, responsibility for a project, for the design in a project is very clear, but authorship is always blurred. There's not a single genius.
Yeah.
Mm. And so that's not from me. That's a belief in the company for a long time. And I was told about that when I joined, which is good. Like I had no sketches to sign. So I'm like, yeah, good. Nobody will notice.
Yeah. Going from automotive to footwear, you know, automotive is like sign your sketches. Like it's part of the art. You go into footwear, there's, you know, 60, 70 people that help you get something to the finish line and, countless others in a factory in Asia that you never get to meet. But man, it's a team sport.
I have to jump into Jason's corner for a second because I don't see you. I know you. He studied transportation at Art Center and was graduated top of his class and all of that. But I remember when Karen and I went to the grad show. It was honestly yours was the only wall that showed fresh thinking. Like did this internship at Tesla. Did this concept for an SUV that was fully modular. They have really product design thinking kind of ideas about switchable kind of jerry cans that were battery packs, looked super cool, flexible system, showed how things were built. And there were other like purists that were just doing these insane, exquisite renderings, but they just didn't have any soul. And that guy's going to get a job at Mazda, but he's not going to riff.
This was like super interesting. So Jason, you might know him. Did you know Marty Smith?
The name sounds familiar, but
when did you graduate in Art Center?
2015.
Huh. Yeah. So Marty Smith was, before he went to Hong Kong, the dean, I think, of Art Center.
Okay.
He went to Hong Kong, was the dean of Polytechnic Product Design, Industrial Design. And I don't know, Karen, if you met him there. Super nice guy, Marty Smith. And he died in a motorcycle accident years ago in California after moving back to LA. His wife, Babette Strauss, I think, is now at Art Center teaching as well. And she's been, I think, the global design operations manager for Nokia at some point. So lovely couple. We did quite a few things with them while we were living in Hong Kong. And I've got really nice memories. He always had cool little cars. And he came by and showed us the cars. And Edgar, like our son back then, was kind of like, you know, sitting in the car and sort of really proud. And so Marty, they moved back to the US and he had a car design background, you know, a lot more sculptural and all that. And he was like always kind of bitching about the Germans and the minimal rational approach, kind of like, but it was just really nice to have somebody who was great at something and a very different belief, but was very open.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so rare, I think, you know, to have that dialogue. And I think if more people and across the industries would be like that, then maybe there would be a little bit less of this kind of like, you know, pigeonholing of people in these particular parts. Because like the nice thing about design is, yes, you need to have a lot of that kind of experience in an industry, and it helps to know the ins and out and all that. But at the end, it's still about fresh ideas and you need different eyes. And sometimes, you know, Brandon, to your point, it's kind of like taking materials, processes, ideas from here, putting them over there and see what happens. And sometimes you kind of like, oh, that's a dud. And sometimes it's just amazing, right?
Back to your first experience of like the critique was you're not doing enough. Like where's more detail? I find that anytime you bring something that you know can apply over here, you got to trust that you're not copying something over. It's going into a new realm and it's going to come out with a different solution. And there will be similarities, but it'll be like the spirit and it'll affect kind of your approach to the system and the business model end up somewhere that has the efficiencies built in from where it came from.
Yeah.
I think that's always coolest.
I'm glad we kept on that.
Yeah.
I think to that end, just to go back to Jason, final thought, Yep. Karen's tapping me on the knee. We've got to get off in a second. But he's the embodiment of that, because starting in transportation, coming up and doing aviation with us, taking those lessons back to Tesla and feeding it into the Model 3 program, then going into footwear and then doing something else and then consulting. It's really nice to have that.
Try to act like an intern everywhere I go, but also professional with experience.
Ever the learner.
By the balance. Yeah.
We're all learners.
Awesome. Well, I think thank you so much for your time. It was an absolute pleasure meeting you.
Thank you. Thank you. Mark, it was nice seeing you, Karen, Brandon, again.
Yeah. Please, we have to catch up. Hopefully we can make it one day to the Midwest, or if you ever come, like,
come to Disneyland.
Come to Disneyland.
Maybe Disneyland. What? Which is said in Anaheim or what?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that one.
Okay. I'll
let you know when we're around.
Make something happen.
If ever you do find yourself in Portland, you're more than welcome to stop in and see Jason at the office and the team. And when we get the compound going, then you're also welcome down here.
Awesome.
All right, mate. Awesome. Thanks so much.
Well, you go. Say hi to Tanya.
I will.
Yeah. Good to see you. Thank you. Bye.